Good evening. If you want to get your Bibles, we are in Hebrews chapter 11 and working our way through that chapter and into the next. We have three classes left tonight and two more after this, and so you do the math on that and you know how far we've got to be able to progress in each of these studies to be able to finish the book. As you study through the book of Hebrews, it is a... Hey, Justin, as you come in, excellent. Could you close those doors? That'd be wonderful. As you study through the book of Hebrews, it is hopefully, as we have spent time on Wednesday nights going through this book, and if you've been in this class, hopefully it's been a beneficial study to you to get into a book of the Bible that helps bring the entirety of the Bible together in order to help us to see the contrast that God has for us to see between that Old Testament and the New Testament. In order to help us to see that that Christ is superior and better, and that was God's ultimate plan. It wasn't that God created some system under that old covenant that was a failure, and so He had to create something new to take its place. God's plan all along was for Christ to come. God's plan all along was for that old covenant to be temporary. He never intended it for it to be permanent. If He had, there would have been no use for Christ to come. Everything that God had in place was to point man and to bring man ultimately to the coming of Jesus Christ. And so here's a book that elevates Christ above everything else and says to the readers, in effect, verse after verse, why would you ever turn your back on Christ? When you have everything that you need in the superiority of Christ, why would you ever go anywhere else? Why would you turn your back on Him and go back to an inferior system by which you cannot be saved? And so he spent the first, basically the first 9.5 chapters really developing that theme of the superiority of Christ. And then beginning in chapter 10 and verse 19, we notice in the last few classes, that's where he begins his very practical section, where he's making some direct application to their lives, telling them that they need to remain faithful. I want you to look in chapter 10 and verse 36, and we're going to use that as our transition point into chapter 11 and carry that through even into chapter 12. In chapter 10 and verse 36, for you have need of what? What did they need? They needed endurance. What was going on with them? They were on the verge of turning their back on Christ. What did they need? They needed to endure those things that they were going through and remain steadfast in their service to Christ. I want you to remember that word endurance. For you have need of endurance so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. Could they or could we receive the promise if we don't endure? It's directly tied together. You must endure in order to receive the promise. You cannot receive the promise if you do not endure. Look in verse 39. We are not of those who draw back or shrink back or withdraw to perdition, to destruction. That's not what we do. If we're children of God, we are of those who have faith to the saving of the soul. We need to endure. What does that mean? We are those who have faith, continually have faith to the saving of our souls. Now, what's faith? Tells you in the next verse. We don't understand what faith is. Faith is the substance, the full assurance, the confidence. It's the foundation of things that are hoped for in the future. It's the evidence. It's that inner conviction. It's the proof of things that are not seen. He gives us that description of faith. Go over to verse 6. And we looked at these first seven verses last week, and that's why we're skipping through this. How important is it for us to have this faith that is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen? If you don't have it, what's the problem? You can't please God. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. Do you know another verse in this book that used the word impossible? Another verse in the book of Hebrews that used the word impossible. It is impossible for God to do something, chapter 6 and verse 18. Is there an inkling of a possibility that God could lie? Not a chance. It's impossible for God to lie. Is there an inkling of a possibility that we could please God if we don't have faith in Him? Not an inkling of a possibility. It is impossible. Now, Why is he talking about pleasing God? What did he say about Enoch in verse 5? Enoch was one who received a testimony, of witness from God that he did what? That he pleased God. Well, what do we need to do? Well, obviously we want to please God, but the only way to please God is to have faith in him, a faith that is an obedient faith. And what we're going to see in this chapter, as he talks about that first couple verses, he talked about the description of faith, but the majority of this chapter deals with a demonstration of faith in the lives of these faithful people. And what he points out is that their faith was not just some mental assent or some feeling that they had in their heart, but their faith was an obedient faith. It's impossible to please God if you don't have an obedient faith. It's impossible to please God in verse 6 if you don't draw near to God. It's impossible to please God if you don't believe that he exists and that he's a rewarder. And it's impossible to please God if you don't diligently seek him. That should be our ultimate goal, to please God. And so what he does, and we've looked at Abel in verse 4, we saw Enoch in verse 5, he starts talking about Noah in verse 7. And what I want us to see is, we're going to briefly look at some of these faithful in verse 11. We don't have time to look at all of them in depth in this study. But what I want us to see as we look at these men and women of faith is that there's a number of qualities and characteristics about their faith. They had an unfaltering trust in God. I want you to think about these faithful that are listed in this chapter. Did their trust in God waver? Did it falter? Seemingly, for many of them, we rarely see any wavering or faltering in their faith. They had a vision for something that was invisible. They could see the invisible. Now, how could they do that? Have you ever seen the invisible? It's a trick question. Have you ever seen the invisible? They could see the invisible. Now, go back to verse 1. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things that are invisible. The evidence of things not seen. Do you have faith? Can you see the invisible? I'm not talking about some spooky, you know, weirding out kind of thing. Can you see God? Can you see the handiwork of God? Do you have faith in God? Sure. You see what the wind does. You see the effect that it has. These characters, their faith was unfaltering. They could see and had a vision for the invisible, and they had a thriving power to just press on in hope, regardless of what was happening. Look at Noah in verse 7. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things that were what? Not yet seen. What did God warn him about? Things he couldn't see. Oh, great. Noah, there's going to be a flood. Great. What's a flood, God? Never seen one of those. When's that going to happen? Oh, 120 years. Wow, okay. That's going to be a while. He was warned of things not yet seen. What's faith? The assurance of things not seen. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, what did he do? His faith moved. It moved with godly fear. What did his faith do? It prepared an ark. Look at all the verbs in here. It prepared an ark. What did the ark do? Saved his household. What else happened with the ark? He condemned the world and he became an heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. Was there any link between Noah's faith and the building of the ark? Yes, an inseparable link. Well, what if Noah had not built the ark? What would that say about his faith? He had no faith. Faith without works is dead. Here was a man who had faith, and that faith was obedient. And those two concepts are inseparable in Scripture. They're inseparable in this chapter. Then in verse 8, we pick up Abraham. He's going to talk about Abraham in verses 8, 9, and 10. Then he's going to talk about Sarah in verses 11 and 12. Then he's going to kind of summarize some of their life, and not just them, but others in verses 13 through 16. And then you go back, you drop down to verse 17, and who does he pick up talking about again? Abraham. Was Abraham a great man of faith? If you were going to have a hall of faith, a hall of fame of the faithful of the Old Testament, could it be complete without Abraham? You know, the longest passages in the New Testament that talk about faith always include Abraham. Romans chapter 4, great chapter on faith. Guess who's in there? Abraham. James chapter 2, a great chapter on faith. Guess who's in there? Abraham. Hebrews chapter 11, great chapter on faith. Guess who's in there? Abraham. You can't talk about faith without talking about this man. But his faith was not just some mental assent or some feeling he had in his heart. It was something that moved him to action. So what did his faith do? Verse 8. By faith, Abraham what? He obeyed. He obeyed when he was called out, when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. Now, what was that place? Where was he going? He didn't know. That's what verse 8 says, right? The end of verse 8. God called him out of his home. He called him out of Ur, and then he called him out of Haran. And then God said, you come out to the place that I will show you. What's faith? The evidence of things not seen. Abraham know where he was going? Could he see it? No. So why did he leave home? By faith. God told him to move. And what did he do? He did what God said. He didn't question God. He didn't say what some people say today and say, well, you know, God, I don't get it. I don't see the connection. Guess what? Abraham didn't see anything. But he moved. By faith, he obeyed God when he was called out of the place to receive that he would receive as an inheritance. He went out not knowing where he was going. That's faith. That's trust. What else did his faith do in verse 9? By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise. Remember the three promises that were made to Abraham? I'll make of you a great nation. That requires descendants, right? Requires children, descendants. I will put your great nation into a great land, and through your great nation in that great land will come a great seed, a great Savior. God made those promises to him in verse 9. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise. Now, how did he dwell there? When Abraham went to the promised land, did he take up permanent residence, build a house, build a city, fortify a city? How did he dwell there in verse 9? He lived as a foreigner. Wait a minute. God said, I'm going to give you this land. Okay, God, I'm here. And God said, wherever your foot walks, I'm going to give it. Okay, I'm walking here. I'm here. And it wasn't his. Not yet. Did not belong to him. Not yet. He's living in tents. How would you like to be Sarah? Leaving home. Where are we going? Don't know. When we get there, where are we going to live? In tents. Y'all been tent camping? That's fun, isn't it? You try tent camping 5,000 miles from here to Alaska and 5,000 miles back Alaska to here. You'll love tent camping. Think about Abraham and Sarah, Isaac, Ishmael, and the children. Think they loved tent camping for a while? Dad, I'm sick of this. I am sick of this. When are we going home? We are home. Great, let's build a house. It doesn't belong to us. What keeps you going? Faith. He dwelt in a land. By the way, when Sarah died and he had to, and they're in this land, he had to go buy a piece of land to bury his wife because he didn't even own land in the place that God had promised to him. Does that take faith? He dwelt in tent with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. What else did his faith do in verse 11? What was he doing? He was waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. That's what the verb means. He was waiting over and over and waiting And when he was done waiting, he waited some more. For what? The city. Which city? Jerusalem? Bethlehem? Nazareth? Which city? Oh, the one that doesn't have, the one that has foundations, not an earthly city, but a city that has foundations whose builder, architect, and maker, constructor, is God. What city is that talking about? I'm talking about heaven. Where was Abraham looking all of this while? What kept him moving? What kept him going? Faith. Faith in God. And where was he looking? Where was his focus? His focus was on heaven. If by faith we put our focus on heaven, everything that happens here on this life, is it going to detour us from our goal? From where we're headed? Here was Abraham who had faith in God. Now, some people have questioned why Sarah is even here. Say, Sarah? You talk about the examples of faith in the Old Testament. Why put Sarah in there? Now, why would some people suggest that, why would you put Sarah in there?
She laughed.
She laughed. God said, you're going to have a child. And what did she do? She laughed. Was she the only one who laughed at that promise? Oh, did somebody else laugh? What was his name? Abraham. We pin that on Sarah in a hurry. But she wasn't the only one. But is that what really characterized Sarah? Was laughing? Now, where did Isaac get his name? His name means laughter. I don't know if anybody in here is named Isaac, and I don't know why you got your name if your name is Isaac. If your mom laughed at the idea she was going to have a child, that's what Sarah did. But that's not what characterized her. What characterized her? By faith, verse 11. Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child. New King James says she bore a child when she was past the age. That's an interesting way to say it. Anybody have a different translation? When she was beyond the proper time of life. Is there a proper time of life, generally speaking, for a woman to have a child? Would you say in round general terms that 90 years old is in that general hemisphere of proper time of life? No. That's why she laughed. But she received strength in order that she might have a child when she was past the age. Because, the end of verse 11, here's why she is in this chapter. Because she judged, she considered, she counted God to be what? Faithful. If God said it, it's going to happen. She considered him to be faithful who had promised. Therefore, this is an interesting verse in verse 12. Therefore, from one man, Abraham, and him as good as dead. Well, that's not a nice thing to say. Him, what does that mean? He's old. All right, you said it, I didn't. He's old. Is he past the, normal age, 100 years old? Good time to have your first child? How would you like to have your first child when you're 100? Hello? No, thank you. All right? That's... I mean, changing diapers when you're 100, chasing the child, dealing with a screaming kid in church when you're 100 years old? No, thank you. He was as good as dead. By the way, Romans chapter 4, what does it say about her womb? Romans chapter 4 talks about the deadness of Sarah's womb. It had never had a child. He's as good as dead. But from that one man came what? As many as the sand of the seashore and the stars in the sky. From that one man. How did that happen? By faith. That's how that happened. So verse 13 says, these all died in faith. That's interesting because how did they live? They lived in faith. They died the same way that they lived. They lived in faith. They died in faith. Blessed are the dead who die in who? In the Lord, Revelation 14 says, where did they die? They died in the Lord. They died in faith. But when they died, they hadn't received the promise yet. Well, what's going on? God made a promise, and we've lived our whole life in faith that promise is going to come true, and they hadn't received it. This isn't talking about the promise of a son. This is talking about that ultimate promise of that coming Savior. But they did see it. Do you see the word seen? Did they see it? Having seen them, the promises, afar off. Let's see. When Abraham died, it was more than 1,500. We could put it more around 1,700 to 1,800 years before Jesus came. Is that afar off? Abraham looked down to the coming of Jesus, 1,700 to 1,800 years from then. By the way, Jesus said in John chapter 8, Abraham rejoiced to see my day. And the Jews made fun of him for saying it. What do you mean Abraham saw your day? Abraham, by faith, knew that God was going to keep his promise about the coming of Jesus. And so it's interesting how he says it. They saw those promises afar off, were assured of them, they embraced them, and they confessed that where they were living, they were strangers and pilgrims. They were foreigners and exiles on the earth. By the way, should we not also be saying that same thing? Are we foreigners, strangers, and pilgrims on this earth? Yes. Is our ultimate citizenship on this earth? No. Where's our ultimate citizenship as Christians? Oh, that's in heaven. What does that make this earth? Not my home. I'm just a passing through. For those, verse 14, those who say such things, those who say, well, I'm just a stranger, a pilgrim here, declare plainly that they seek a what? The end of verse 14. Homeland, anybody got anything different? They seek their own country. Is that, did anybody have own? They seek their own country. They seek their homeland. Wait a minute. Where was he living? He was right there in the promised land. This is it. And God said, nope, they're seeking their homeland. Is that talking about Mesopotamia? Is that the homeland that he was seeking? No. Because the next verse says, if he wanted to, he could have gone back there. What's your homeland? Anybody born in Florida? Anybody born in West Palm? That's your homeland? There's several of us here, right? Where's your homeland? Your homeland is where you're from. But this wasn't talking about Mesopotamia. Where was Abraham from? He was from God. That was his father's land. His father's land was heaven. That's what he was seeking. If he had wanted to go back home to Mesopotamia, he could have done it in verse 15. But now, verse 16, they desire, key word, a better. What is it? A heavenly country. Therefore, God's not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. What kind of faith did it take? What kind of faith did it take when you couldn't see it to see it? Notice it says he didn't know where he was going, but he could see where he was going. Huh? How's that possible? You trust in God. You have faith in God. He couldn't see it, verse 17. Verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son. What was the promise? Through your seed, I'm going to make a great nation. Fine and dandy. I'm 100 years old and I have my first child. I have my begotten child through whom this promise is going to be made in Isaac. And this was a number of years later that he offers up his only son, Isaac. If you were Abraham, God says, Isaac's your promised son. Through him, you're going to have a great nation. And then God says, sacrifice Isaac. What are you going to do? My only son, great nation through him, sacrifice Isaac. God, this doesn't connect. From point A to point B, I'm missing something because something's not really fitting here. Is that what Abraham did? You know what, God? That's your problem, God. I'm going to let you figure that one out. You said that. You said this. Whatever you say. What a concept. Instead of punching back at God and saying, wait a minute, God, you said this. Now you're saying this. Forget it. I'm done. This doesn't make sense to me. Instead of fighting back against God, what did he do? All right, God, you know what? This is your deal. I'm going to let you figure it out. So verse 18, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Verse 19, what did he conclude? concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. If that's what had to be done, you know what? Let God take care of it. This is God's problem. I'm just going to do what God says. Can I go wrong in doing what God says? Nope. I've never gone wrong in doing what God says. I'll just do what God says and let God figure this out. Figuring God was able to raise him from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Did he receive Isaac figuratively from the dead to begin with? Yeah. He was a dead man. What was that? Verse 14? Where is that? Deadness. Verse 12. He was as good as dead. Sarah's womb was as good as dead. The deadness of her womb in Romans chapter 4. Where did Isaac come from initially? From the dead. God brought life. And Abraham thought, you know what? God can do it again. Is that faith? Do we have that kind of faith that takes God at his word and says, whatever God says, that's what I'm going to do, and I'm not going to argue about it. I'm not going to say, you know what, God, I'm just not getting that one. You don't have to get it. You just got to do it. You got to do what God says. And so Isaac in verse 20, Jacob in verse 21, Joseph in verse 22, their faith all looks to the future. And you can read those verses and see how they're all looking to things that were yet unseen. You get down to verse 23, it begins talking about Moses, but it's not talking about Moses' faith in verse 23. It's talking about Amram and Jochebed's faith, his parents' faith when they hid him when he was a child. And then verse 24 begins talking about Moses' faith and how incredible is his faith. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, 40 years old, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He renounced his upbringing, all the power, the wealth, the palaces, the privileges, everything that came with it. He renounced it, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So what did he do instead? Verse 25, instead he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God. Doesn't sound like a good trait. I will renounce all of the privileges that come with Pharaoh's house, and instead I'm going to go out here with the people of God and suffer. Moses, you feel like you got any screws loose up top? I mean, that's just not fitting. Why would you do that? He chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting, temporary, passing pleasures of sin. Does it take faith to see the difference between following God and following the world? Does that take faith?
Amen.
People of the world say, you Christians, you're a little bit crazy. You know, because you're not enjoying everything that we're enjoying. You're following rules that we don't have to follow. And you're doing things and not doing things that we're enjoying. And people of the world say, that doesn't make any sense. And yet to people of faith who know God and trust God, we need to say, God, whatever you want. I'll make that choice. You think about that. As Joe says, a comment was made about it's difficult when your government legalizes sin. Is our government the first government that's legalized sin? Not in the history of the world. We're beginning to taste some of what individuals and believers have dealt with in years past. And that's hard. And the tendency may be to back away from it and not to choose suffering, but to choose the easy path. But verse 26 says, he made a choice. He esteemed, he considered the reproach of Christ. He considered the reviling that would become because he followed God greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Well, how do you do that? He could see tangibly, visibly see the treasures of Egypt. Could he see the treasures of following God? Maybe not so much. What's faith? Substance of things hoped for. Evidence of things not seen. What was he looking at the end of verse 26? He looked to the reward. The word looked there is a word that means he took his eyes off of everything else in order to look at one thing. That's faith. Take your eyes off of everything else that this world wants to push at you and look at one thing. He looked to the reward. He forsook Egypt, Verse 27, because he endured as seeing him, he could see God who is what? How can you see God who is invisible? You put your trust in God. You put your trust in his word. And here was a man who was going to do just that by faith. By the way, he endured. Remember what we saw in chapter 10? We have need of endurance. Here's Moses who endured. By verse 28, by faith, he kept the Passover, sprinkling of blood, lest he be destroyed, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch him. By faith, verse 29, the Israelites passed through the Red Sea as by dry land. Would it take faith for you to walk out in the middle of the Red Sea? With a wall of water there and a wall of water there. That going to take faith for you to walk out there? Would you have been the first person out? I mean, if you're like several thousand people deep in line, okay, well, it's working for them, I guess. I guess we, you know, would you have been the first person in line? By faith, that first person walked through on dry land. Does faith have any doubt mixed in with it? No, they walked through by faith. Verse 30, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. Walk around the city and the walls are going to fall down? That doesn't make sense. If they had thought that, would the walls have fallen down? Nope. Walls would still be standing. If they thought, you know, God, that doesn't make sense. But by faith, they obeyed. And so you notice that it wasn't some mental sin. It wasn't some feeling in their heart that knocked those walls down. It was their faith in obedience. What about Rahab in verse 31? By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe. Anybody have a different translation? She did not perish with those who did not believe. She did not perish with those who were disobedient when she had received the spies with peace. Where did Rahab live? What city did she live in? Jericho. Was she a Jew? No. Had she been raised in a Jewish home being taught about Jehovah God? No. She learned about God and learned about God's people living in Jericho. Was she the only one? No. If you go back and read Joshua chapter 2, when the spies came, she said, "We all have heard, and we all have quaked and been fearful of what we have heard about God and about the Israelites and what's happening with you." She wasn't the only one who knew, but she was the only one who had faith in God, the only one who believed and obeyed God. So verse 32, we've said a couple times during this that the book of Hebrews reads a lot like a sermon in several places, and it may have been a sermon at one point. And verse 32 sort of sounds sort like a sermon. What more shall we say? For the time would fail me. I don't have time in this sermon. You ever heard a preacher say anything like that? The time would fail me. I don't have time to talk about it. But what is it? Time would fail me to tell of Gideon. Can you imagine? Go back and talk about some of the Old Testament faithful. Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah. What about David? David just gets a name mentioned. Could you talk about David's faith? What about Samuel and the prophets? Who, through faith, underscore that. He's going to tell us what they did, but what they did was through faith. None of this would have been possible without faith. What did they do? They subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, they obtained promises, they stopped the mouths of lions. Can you think of some who did? They quenched the violence of fire, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong. They became valiant in battle. How was David able to kill his tens of thousands? How was he able to be valiant in battle? Was it by faith in God? When David went up against Goliath, what was it that caused him to be able to defeat Goliath? Faith. It's just faith in God. Turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women receive their dead, raised to life again. You think about the widow of Zarephath. You think about the Shunammite woman. Others were tortured. Others were tortured. The word here is a word that was used to talk about a drum. Skin being stretched across a drum and that drum being beat. That's the word that's used here. used elsewhere to talk about torture, talk about stretching a drum and beating a drum. How were these people tortured? Their bodies were stretched. Their bodies were beaten like a stretched drum. But what does it say? They did not accept deliverance. That means deliverance was offered. Not accepting deliverance. They did not accept the release to get out of it. Why? That they may obtain a better resurrection. They weren't going to give up on their God or on their faith. They knew something better was coming. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings. Yes, of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. We don't have any biblical record of somebody being sawn in two, but Jewish tradition says that at least Jewish tradition records that Isaiah was sawn in two. Can you imagine being sawn in two because of your faith? They were slain by the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins, goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented. Verse 38, of whom the world was not worthy. Who said that? Whose evaluation of these people was the world wasn't worthy of them? God said that. God said, you see my people down there? The world is not even worthy of them. I wonder if God could say the same thing about us. Look at their faith. Look at their obedience. The world's not even worthy of them. Wandered in deserts, mountains, dens, caves of the earth. And all these, verse 39, having obtained a good testimony through faith. What was that good testimony? The world's not worthy of them. They're accepted by God. They receive the honor of God, but they did not receive the promise. God having provided something, key word, better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. What had they, these Jewish converted to Christ Christians, what had these Christians received? They've got the promise of heaven. Through whom? Through their high priest that this book talked about. They've received, what is this promise? What did these Jewish, or these faithful of old, what promise had they not received yet? Jesus hadn't come yet. Jesus hadn't come yet, therefore forgiveness hadn't come yet, therefore fellowship with God, true fellowship with God hadn't come yet, therefore promise of heaven hadn't come yet. And they all died without having that promise in hand. Guess what promise we have in hand right here today? We've got Jesus. We've got forgiveness. We've got fellowship. We've got eternal life right here in our hand as a Christian. Is that better? That's what we have been provided. And so he says, therefore, chapter 12, verse 1, therefore, we also, think about this, we also, here's all of these faithful who have gone before us and have run their race successfully, run it faithfully, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, we have all of these faithful, these heroes of faith, whose examples we can follow, what do we need to do? Let us lay aside every weight. There are things that get in our way in running the Christian life. What do we need to do? Lay them aside. Get rid of them. And let us lay aside the sin. And New King James says that so easily ensnares us. It's the sin that clings to us. It's the sin. God says, get rid of it. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. All of these witnesses, all of these faithful of old, they had run their race. Remember what chapter 10 and verse 36 said? You have need of endurance. Chapter 12 and verse 1. We need to run our race with endurance. What's our race? Is it a sprint or a marathon? Christian race. It's a marathon. It is a constant race that we are running for Christ. And he says, whatever is going to hinder you, whatever is going to hold you back, whatever is going to weigh you down, whatever sin is going to cling to you and keep you from running, get rid of it. That's what faith does. Faith says, I've got to get rid of these things so that I can run this race that's set before me, because guess who I have in verse 2? I need to look unto Jesus. A similar verb used here. Taking my eyes off of everything else, what do? Look at Jesus. What did Peter first do when he got out on that water? He had his eyes off of everything else, and where was he looking? Looking at Jesus. Looking unto Jesus, who is he? The author, the pioneer, the leader, and the perfecter, the finisher, perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him. We have a race set before us in verse 1. Jesus had the joy set before him. And what did he do? We have need of endurance, chapter 10, verse 36. We need to run our race with endurance, chapter 12 and verse 1. What did Jesus do? Did he endure? Did he endure something greater than we will ever will? He endured the crucifixion. He endured the cross. Despised, disdained, thought down upon the shame that came with that crucifixion. And what happened to him? He is now sitting down at the right hand of the throne of God. If we keep our eyes on Jesus, he's that promise. He's the promise that Old Testament faithful did not have. But we've got him. And so we have need of endurance in chapter 10. And what chapter 11 is a pause in between chapter 10 and chapter 12 to say, don't lose sight of what real faith is. If we've got real faith, we can endure anything that comes. We'll stay faithful to Christ no matter what comes. And we will be able to run faithfully and with endurance until the end so that we can receive that promise. We'll pick up here next week. And we've got to finish chapter 12 next week and then do chapter 13 after that. Thank you so much, y'all. Great attention tonight, and I appreciate that.